Hello, Shockwaves listeners. Rob G here. Before we kicked off episode 57 of Shockwaves, I just wanted to give you a quick little message. As I'm recording this, it is Sunday, July 16th, and we've just gotten the news that George Romero has passed. It's a bit of a shocker for all of us and completely unexpected and a total bummer. We were literally just talking about Land of the Dead on the last episode, and George meant a lot to all of us. He changed cinema history. He changed horror history. A lot of what we see today, including The Walking Dead, is all because of him. And we want to pay tribute to him as soon as we're able to. The episode you're about to hear with special guest Gary Sherman was actually recorded about a week ago. And it was mostly just because of his timing. He was in town for a screening of Deathline, and he's a guest we've always wanted to have on, so we did everything we could to make that happen, and thankfully it all lined up. But because of that, this is a little bit we didn't anticipate this happening, and we thought it might be weird if you heard the episode and we didn't address the recent passing of George Romero, as well as Martin Landau, who I just found out about. So rest assured, we will absolutely do our tributes to both of them on the next episode of Shockwaves. But in the meantime, celebrate, watch one of George's movies this week, and we hope you enjoy episode 57 with Gary Sherman. Okay, and welcome to episode 57 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Mr. Elric Kane.
Achievement unlocked.
Which
that's all I'm going to say about later on in today's episode. One of the dream guests.
We've been talking about this one for years.
One of my dream, but just definitely someone I've always wanted. I think back on Inside Horror, this is a guest I used to look up and always be bummed that he wasn't from LA and realizing
right.
I might
if there was ever
him.
A chance that he was going to be on the show and you weren't in town, I was like, we cannot do it because you are Wings Hauser reincarnated.
True story. The only time I was in a bar in New Zealand, and a guy came up to me. I was like 21, and he came up to me. He goes, "Man, you look just like Wings Hauser." And I had no idea who it was. I had to go and look the guy up, and there's no similarity between us at all. And then I see a photo from Vice Squad, and there's a shirt he's wearing, and I have the exact shirt, and my hair looks the same.
King.
I was like, "Holy
Googling
shit!"
Wings Hauser.
Well, look, Wings Hauser.
That's right. And the Googler is our co-host Rebecca McKendry.
What up, guys?
Welcome, and of course, last but not least, Mr. Ryan Turek.
Good evening.
Good evening, indeed. So this is a special episode. We have somebody from out of town coming on in a bit.
Yeah.
And you do vaguely look like Wings Hauser. Very vaguely. It's the hair.
You have to see him in motion.
Not at all.
I'll show you a photo from my past.
Oh, okay. That picture
does. It's kind of the hair.
Yeah.
Like, look at this one. Even,
well,
like,
you get
like
those
you're
cheeks.
Aging
well, now, yeah.
with Wings
yeah,
Hauser,
yeah,
too.
Well,
like,
no,
that's kind of getting Kane-like.
From the movie and the way he acts in the movie is actually Elric's how he reacts at conventions once he has a little bit of alcohol in him.
How I treat Becca is basically how Ramrod treats prostitutes.
I love that. You know, people think you treat me like that all the time just because you talk shit on the air. Like, people are like, why do you even hang out with him? And I'm like, I swear to God.
Why do you? I don't know.
Well, I don't know.
That's
you
another
know what?
Episode.
That's a whole other, yeah.
We'll have to do a therapy episode.
Because you like white pimps. You're a sucker for white pimps, and that's how I roll.
People right, actually so. Talk to me off air, and really? They're like, does he really talk to you like that?
Zero
and I'm like,
abusive.
No.
Yeah, we've talked about this. Yeah. It's like the perception that we put out there is that we're all assholes. Yeah. And then everybody's like, what's it like after you stop recording? We're like, we're totally fine.
It's fine. It's fine.
Our kids play together.
Yeah.
Backyard barbecue.
That's why you got to meet us at a convention.
Man.
That's where you'll get the warm and fuzzies.
The reality of
right.
it.
Yes, no, somebody even commented on Pearson, I think it was Kat Kanifi. She goes, hey, Elric on this show doesn't seem like as harsh and like mean. I was like, it's the softer Elric. I'm like, that's not intentional.
Wow.
If Becca was on that, I'd be exactly
yeah,
the same.
So like that. Go fuck yourself, Kane.
Wow.
So because we're kind of like going all over the place. So,
yes.
A buddy of mine from Toronto, Trevor Henderson, he does a lot of great artwork up there. Today he tweeted something that I didn't know, and this kind of ties into the Friday the 13th video game. He said, just found out that there was going to be a teenage Jason playable in Friday the 13th wearing his mom's sweater as a mask. It would be so creepy. And then he took a photo of him wearing a blue mother's sweater from Friday the 13th. Now imagine a Jason Voorhees that looked like this.
Oh, wow. That
looks fucking
been a really
cool,
good
right?
Mask.
What if a teenage Jason used mom's sweater to wrap up his face?
Would have been hot.
I think it's great.
That's but yeah,
that's kind of cool.
I came across that today and I was like, that is rad. Now I want to see a movie.
Because it's a new idea.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of new ideas.
Rob, what is that?
New ideas?
New? Nothing.
The fans will tear you alive.
We're talking about new ideas within the realm of a franchise that's been around for quite a while.
Oh, and Jason in the Snow, of course. They need to add that, apparently.
No.
Just one sequence.
Just one sequence.
It's the opening.
All right. Anyways.
Where is Jason before we move on? Have we heard anything? Has there been any pulse
update? It's tied up in a legal battle because of Victor and Sean Cunningham.
Victor Miller, the writer, yeah.
I guarantee you we will not see a Friday the 13th film in quite a while.
Oh,
that's a shame.
Gosh.
Total shit.
What about the TV show? That grinded to a halt as well.
Well, we heard it grounded to a halt, and then Sean was on our show, and he was very adamant that it's still going to happen.
It's still tied up with the legal stuff.
Oh, that's also part of that, huh?
I can name 25 people right now who pitched for that. Like, it was in works for so long, and they kept
back on.
Did you?
I may have signed NDAs as well.
Here we go.
All right.
Jason's in the works.
On the plus side, we get a new Halloween film. A year and a bit from now. So that's something to look forward to.
You get a new Halloween film October 19th, 2018.
That's one thing to look for.
I can't wait for that. Let's talk about crap we've seen. Not crap.
Oh, crap.
Good stuff. I didn't mean crap. You know what
crap.
I meant.
I thrive on crap.
So it's been a while. I mean, we reported on a few things last week, but it's been a while because we had a pretty lengthy break. So I'm sure there were plenty of things we didn't get to last week. I'll start really quickly. Actually, I'm all about werewolves this week. So I got the Paul Naschy box set from Scream Factory. They just put it out with the five features in it. And I vaguely remember when these made it on DVD, but they weren't in a box set. So I only saw a few of them kind of scattered. But I went straight to the last movie in the set, which is Night of the Werewolf from 1981. And Ryan, you'd love this because it is the same music from Tentacles.
So it's
you know, Paul Naschy, who I think wrote and directed this one as well, stars as a wolf man that is getting – it's like the medieval times, and they are killing a woman who is a witch slash vampire.
Okay.
I wasn't really sure because she also bathes in blood, so I'm like, oh, is this supposed to be the Bathory thing too?
I thought this was like hashtag all about werewolves.
We'll get there. So there's two. There's this woman who is kind of a Bathory vampire witch who's getting killed, as well as Paul Naschy because he's a wolf man. Yep. They put the iron mask on him and they stake him in the heart.
Oh.
And all of a sudden we get that awesome Tentacles music. And you're like, whoa, I like this already. And then, of course, as happens in these movies, some grave robbers come and they take the stake out of his heart. And he immediately transforms because it's a full moon. The movie of – I don't remember the other Paul Naschy movies, but I thought this one was pretty awesome. And it felt – even though it's Spanish – it was very in line with what the Hammer movies are like.
Sure.
Because his werewolf looks great. Like, I mean, he's super short, so that's a little awkward. But his actual werewolf looks great. And what I liked about this is it's not just a werewolf movie because obviously they resurrect this vampire Bathory woman. Mm-hmm. And then she resurrects like zombies. So at one point, like a giant zombie comes up and he has to fight that.
It sounds like a kitchen sink
movie. So it is. It's a kitchen sink movie. It's pretty rad. And I watched it with the English dub just because there's something charming about kind of like the English dubbed versions of these old movies. So
nice.
So that's my first foray into the Paul Naschy box set, which I thought was pretty cool,
you know,
and
I think
recommend.
I think someone else out there should just take famous trailers and just apply the Tentacles music to each and every one of these trailers. Imagine
really
Tom Cruise running to the Tentacles.
You can play it at
the
Slashback video opening.
You could.
That's a very emotive song.
Yeah. I gotta say, Paul Naschy, that whole stuff is a real blind spot for me. I know him. He was in
People Who
Are
in
the
Dark.
Yeah, that you recommended.
Awesome.
And I saw that, and it was like a name I've known my
whole
life.
Which Sean Cunningham has nothing to do with.
That's
he
right.
actually does.
He does. That was after the fact.
Yeah, it was after the fact.
We brought up, he knew it from a different title.
Yeah, he was like, I worked on this Spanish film. It was crap. I had a miserable time.
I heard your interview with him, and I was like,
why is his name on it? And then we were like, oh, okay. And then I was like, I bet that was People Who Are in the Dark.
Someone told me after, he's like, he didn't realize you were talking about that Spanish movie that was crap that he mentioned 2 minutes earlier.
Good.
So if you're listening to this, please tweet at me which Paul Naschy film I should jump in with. What's a good lead off of the kind of werewolf cycle films? Because there's a whole bunch.
Oh, you want to ignore me? My recommendation is Night of the Werewolf.
You only saw one.
Sorry.
You said you've only seen
he
one.
He wants an expert.
And I want somebody who's seen more than one movie.
Fine. All right, pure cinema
as
guy.
As if
you
get
your
seen
expert
all the movies. I want to know which one.
Cinema police.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. All right, what about you guys?
I'll jump in. So I am doing – sometimes I get these like freelance research projects that I'll do for people. A lot of times when people are writing books that may have nothing to do with horror, they'll bring me in to like tell them about giallo films. And I'll literally provide like a book report so that they don't have to spend eons researching horror stuff. And so this one, the guy's writing a book about politics in the 80s, but he wanted to do a little bit on the Satanic Panic and how the media and films responded. So I've been researching the Satanic Panic for this.
Did you look at Keirla's big
book? I just got – I've literally been doing this for like 3 days now. So I just ordered the book. There's a couple other Satanic Panic books that I've ordered that I'm pretty psyched about. But I've been trying to kind of start dipping into some of the Satanic Panic movies. But what's interesting is that usually when there was some type of massive social event, like the Vietnam War, we had very reactive horror films come out right afterwards. You know, Abu Ghraib, we have very reactive horror films come out right afterwards. There was not as much of a reaction to the Satanic Panic. We see it come in a little bit in some of like the heavy metal horror films. And then we had like the first Power. There was like a couple of like Satan movies that came out. I mean, Monsters and Mazes.
Because it wasn't much of a panic.
Yeah, it really, apparently Hollywood was just like, whatevs, we're making creatures. And this was the 80s, so everything was about bigger is better. And it definitely did not fall into 80s trends. So I've been trying to uncover hints of Satanism in 80s horror film. So,
well, it's also kind of like a false scare, like in a way, because Vietnam is a big thing to react to, right? But the Satanic Panic is kind of being fabricated by parents and politicians and people who don't like something and are freaked out about something that doesn't even exist
genuine stories every week about people being kidnapped and, you know, sacrificed.
But even still, you usually would see some type of like
a bleed over
or a reaction, especially because like it's ripe for it. I mean, like the Michelle Remembers book that kind of kicked the whole thing off about this girl who has all these old memories came out in 1980. And then even like the most famous Say You Love Satan book came out in late 80s, like 87, 88. And when you're looking back at the decade and kind of the hype and the how it started getting bigger and how everyone in middle America, well, not even middle, I was on the East Coast in suburbia being told that the kid down the street was worshiping Satan.
Well, West Memphis 3 is the most like perfect crystallized example of what's happening.
Did you date him?
No, but I did think he had really cool hair. I remember that, like mom
Satanists
telling me.
Satanists do have great hair.
I remember that they didn't tell me directly, but I deeply, like this is an embedded memory of mom and our next door neighbor standing in the backyard talking about how this kid down the street, his name was Scott, was clearly worshiping Satan and they didn't know if they should like tell the school or his parents or something. And I remember thinking, because they were talking about it and about how, you know, you could do it for power and things like that and you could play records backwards. And I remember thinking like, whoa, you can just like play a record backwards and like Satan appears. Like it seems so crazy cool.
She played a record backwards. It was like, Scott loves you.
Playing that Smurfs album.
The House of the Devil is the most, I feel like, even though it came way later and it's the one film that
Satanic
feels like
panicky.
Yeah, it's the one only great. Movie I can think of that really feels like what that should feel like.
We did have a brief glimpse of some Satan movies come out in the late 80s. So that's where I've been focusing a lot of my research. So I watched The Seventh Sign from 1988. This is the Demi Moore movie the locusts come and then everything turns to blood and she keeps having these visions of God appearing saying you have to sacrifice yourself for your baby. And I remember this movie scaring the shit out of me when I was a kid. Like I watched it way too young. We weren't religious people, so I didn't understand any of the imagery. I was just like, dude, there's bugs everywhere and that's terrible. And I didn't understand what was happening at the end. So it was absolutely terrifying for me as a kid. Not as terrifying now. It definitely feels a bit more like Demi Moore's trying for an Oscar performance, but it's still like a horror movie, so it did not hold up as well as I thought it might.
Talk about movie that time forgot. I completely forgot this movie existed.
Yeah.
The and only then I looked it up.
The cover you recall. 1988.
The cover.
The
cover
brings
the only thing I remember, maybe you guys know, there was like – I remember on a show, it was almost like an early reality show, because isn't there like a Down syndrome like actor in it? Mm-hmm. I remember a show about the Down syndrome actor and it being about him doing a role in The Seventh Son.
Oh, wow.
Like the going on set and actually doing the whole thing. For some reason, I remember that more than the actual movie.
Looking this up, it's John Taylor.
Yeah. I remembered like a lot of the different signs, like the creatures, sea creatures walk on the earth and things like that. Like a lot of it being really terrifying. And I remembered that throughout the whole movie, they repeat this line, "Would you die for him? Would you die for him?" And it like comes up in her dreams and she hears it while she's driving. And then at the end, she has
Becca
to
acting,
answer.
Becca acting.
I know, Becca acting. It's great. give me the "would you die for him" line in any movie. But
can somebody
gif
what she just did? Is there such thing as an audio gif?
Who says that? Is it Michael Bean or Jürgen Prochnow? Do you hear whose voice do you hear?
Actually, it comes from a couple of different people. But it's ultimately like in some of the flashbacks, it's Pontius. It's supposed to be like a pilotish character asking it. And again, this is me with my rocky religious background. In some of them, it's like Jesus asking it, but it's but then Jesus is being, it shows like the crucifixion and everything, and the people who are doing the crucifixion are asking it. So it's repeated. And I just remember that line. And then at the end, Demi Moore has to answer it. And it's like the big climactic moment of the movie.
Wow.
So it did not hold up as well as I thought it would. But the other movie that it reminded me of was one that I kind of really liked called The Reaping. Do you remember that? It's Hilary Swank.
Am I getting the name wrong?
It is The Reaping,
right? No, it's like Abominable Dr. Fibes. It has all the different...
It's still like, you know, is
Plagues.
It causing...
This is Joel Silver's company, Dark Castle. It was a Dark Castle film.
Is that the right one? Yeah.
Yeah, Stephen Hopkins from Predator 2 directed it, Ghost in the Darkness. Yeah, this was like one of those last gasp horror movies that came out of like that 2005, 2007 era of horror. Well,
right around the same time as that Kate Hudson one and the New Orleans.
Skeleton Key, which is much better.
These were like big budget studio horror
with
films.
With big stars.
I remember enjoying The Reaping and I remember being like really impressed at the time because it had like digitized bug swarms and things like that. obviously, that one's not part of the Satanic Panic, but if you're going to watch The Reaping or if you're looking for a movie about all the different apocalyptic signs, go Reaping over Seventh Sign.
Speaking of Satan, I just got to do a quick plug because
speaking of Satan,
it's so relevant. While you're doing your research, Tony Giles, my buddy that does the music stuff, he just did an episode of Cuts from the Crypt. And it's the sixth episode, so he titled it 666, and it's all music from satanic movies.
Ooh.
Oh, nice.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, most of the satanic movies, like when I was looking back, like when we had the surpluses.
It's short, but it's...
They're all from the 70s. Like we were before the satanic panic, the horror industry was. Because that's right at the end of the 70s is when we have Exorcist, Omen, you know, Race with the Devil, To the Devil a
but
Daughter.
It's probably those movies that then influenced the fear of that thing.
We fed the satanic fear.
I only had one, so I'll be quick. But speaking of other podcasts, because you just gave me a segue, on the last episode of Pure Cinema, we did a high school episode, and I recommended Hello, Mary Lou, Prom Night 2. But the reason I'm bringing it up is it just landed on this is after the fact.
For no rhyme or reason.
For no rhyme or reason, it popped up on Amazon Prime.
Wait, what?
Hello, Mary Lou, Prom Night 2.
Oh, my God.
Are you
Amazon
fucking
Prime
serious?
Right now.
I know, because I recorded this like 5 weeks ago, so I had there was no way this was going to time up.
I have the DVD
too. I think it's meant to look really good, but it's not a different cut. It's the same cut.
Okay, all right.
So it should look good. Anyway, I stand by that
Holy
movie.
I've never seen Ryan jump on his phone quicker.
Seriously, because
gotta text the friends.
You talk about like these kind of gaps in the horror education. I've never seen
it's so
this
much
film.
Fun, dude. It's so much fun.
Oh my god, you've
never
seen it.
It's not quite Fright Night 2.
It's
but
fun.
It's very
it's
close.
It's really fun.
I have the one sheet in my drawer, like the original one sheet. I've never seen.
You're gonna freaking love it because not only is it not a sequel to Prom Night, but it's actually a sequel to Carrie.
Yeah,
fuck yeah, I'm in.
But with Nightmare on Elm Street as its biggest influence, like those Freddy movies. What if we did a sequel to Carrie and she was like Freddy,
and she's a prom queen.
And it's good.
Yep. And it's funny and really well made. And Michael Ironside's the principal.
And I'll actually say, I don't
sold
hate
across the board.
Prom Night 3. Follow it up.
See, I never watched that one, but
I swear, there's something charming about it.
Prom Night 3.
One goes camp,
but the film I saw,
it's very self-aware.
I'm sorry.
I didn't watch that one. That's okay. That's okay. I watched. Which is really exciting for the first time, Steven Spielberg's Spontaneous Combustion.
Oh.
Steven Spielberg.
Get out of here, you.
That's a tie back to last week's episode. Because technically, technically is probably directed by Toby Hooper.
Mike Williamson is on his way over to beat you up.
I mean, I just assume Spielberg did everything.
Did Williamson respond to last week's episode?
He was accepting of it.
Anyway, I had never seen Toby Hooper's Spontaneous Combustion, which is a Code Red Blu-ray that I borrowed from Brian, and it looks great. So if you've never seen this movie like me, I'd never really heard good things about it, so I'd never been all that jazzed to check it out.
I don't know much about it. Where does this fall in his...
You know, it's still big. It still looks like a big movie. The effects are rad. I mean, the only real reason to watch this movie is because the effects are so fun, because it's basically bodies bursting into flame, body parts bursting into flame. So it basically opens with two parents in the 50s. They basically are sitting there and they're going to test an atomic bomb next to them to see if a fallout shelter works.
Yes.
And they're going to be America's first couple to survive radiation. And they try it and they survive and everything's great. And then the woman gets pregnant and she has a baby. And right as the baby's born, both of them basically burst into flames and die. And the baby survives. Cut to 30 something years later.
Is the scene presented as silly as it sounds?
No, it's kind of scary and disturbing.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, the film has some really goofy parts. It's definitely again a sign when, you know, I feel like Toby's films are, you know, halfway there, sometimes a little half baked. anyway, that's funny to me.
Kane, you're just too quick for us.
No, I got it. I just chose not to react.
He chose to suppress his humor. What's cool about it is it's Toby actually trying to do a Cronenberg film. It's very much a body horror film. It's about a guy whose, you know, body is changing, and he has no idea about his history, and doesn't know what happened to his parents, and suddenly bad things start to happen to him, and there's a part where his arm bursts into flame, where it's just like, it's kind of terrifying, but it's also fun because there's some really goofy nods to other movies. For one, John Landis has this big cameo where he gets, you know, the shit blown out of him.
Wow.
There's reanimator vials and liquids with bright green liquids and injections into people, and you're like, what the hell is this? So it's kind of throwing everything into a movie. That's why it doesn't work that well. It also has an imitation of The Fly love story that it's trying desperately hard to make work, and it never really, you know, kind of works. But Brad Dourif is the lead of this, and romantic lead in a sense, and he's really good and he's fun to watch, but it's a super weird movie. I think it's above a curiosity piece though, because the effects are really good, and if you're looking for like a movie you haven't seen, you know, from that period, I think it's good. But the problem with this movie, man, it's almost like you get to the end of a movie and they've had most of their big moments and you're just looking for it to wrap up, and this thing just goes to black and you know, the last 2 minutes, it's almost like somebody said, nope, you lost all your funding. Shut down right now. And you're like, but we just have to shut it down right now. I mean, literally, it's the weirdest ending I've ever seen, where it just cuts the credits. You're like, whoa, where did the rest of... But, you know, you kind of get most of the movie in there. Wow. Anyway, it's on the Code Red Blu-ray.
Interesting. And I'll give you a fun tidbit about why I assume John Landis is in that movie.
Yeah.
Is because I didn't discover this until the last time I watched it, but and I did an article on our website, but in Coming to America...
Yep, which is one of the greatest movies ever. Yeah.
Toby Hooper is uncredited, but he cameos in that movie.
Oh.
It's like the party.
Where?
I did a screen grab of it and I put it in this article. Basically, it's the party at the house when it first cuts there, and like Arsenio Hall is like that crazy evangelist.
Uh-huh.
He's talking to a very confused Toby Hooper, who's just standing there with like a bottle of booze in it, and he's like, and so.
Well, he cameos in this too. He's got a cigar, and you're just like, why is Toby Hooper? But we love Toby here.
We do.
Bless him. I watched this film for the first time last year, and I could, there was such a weird disconnect.
Yeah,
I thought it would be a film that would definitely be for me because I had seen all the imagery and Toby Hooper.
That's the best part of
but
it.
But there's something very
the story doesn't
weird
really ever get started.
Totally off.
It's totally weird, and it kind of starts narrative, and then halfway through it kind of has this weird side slasher story where you're like, what?
Yeah.
But for the effects alone, I watched it and I was like, you know what, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like watching bodies burst into flame and impractical effects is something rare now.
Yeah.
Ryan?
Yeah, I saw two films. I'm just going to knock them off. I saw Twisted Nightmare, which
ooh, I've been wanting to see that.
Upon your recommendation, Elric, because you told me, you know, it's a slasher film. So I was like, okay. I bought it sight unseen from Code Red. And mind you, it was the quickest shipping possible. I'm going to give a little plug to him over there. So yeah, because I mean, like, everybody was like complaining about the delays.
Yeah.
I put in my order Monday. I had it Thursday.
Damn.
And I was like, thank you, Code
Red.
Walked
that's
it over.
Like prime level of awesome.
Anyways,
is this from the Ronin Flick store?
What?
Or Code Red Direct.
Code Red. They have like I got it from Code Red Direct. Right. Yeah. So this is Paul Hunt's stellar slasher film. Wink. Not really. Yeah.
Scroll up to the cover.
It's a really, this is like a USA Up All Night movie that I would have caught. There's not, you know, I'm fine with the Friday the 13th knockoffs, even when they're shot on the same locations as some of the Friday the 13th films, Higgins Haven. But there's not much to really sink my teeth into and go.
You weren't surprised by the monster? When I first saw him, I was like, what is that?
Well, the first 5 minutes, I was like, oh, wow, there's some mystical mumbo-jumbo bullshit here. And then they just kind of like start focusing on our you know, cast of characters, which includes crazy
– long mustache guy?
Yeah, long mustache guy, super buff dude who is packing an arsenal for a camping trip.
That's right.
Yeah. He's like bringing his bow and arrow, bringing his Glock, bringing his machine gun. And then his hot babe is like, baby, you need all that. He's like, you never know what's out in the woods.
It has a shared universe with Mutilator, I think. I think they live in the same world. Full break.
I mean, there was a little bit of like fun value getting to know some of these characters in the first 20 minutes. But then it just kind of devolves into a typical, you know, body count movie. I'll keep it in the collection just because.
But the killer is fun to watch. I mean, it's not like a normal. I thought he was kind of interesting because it was like, is that a werewolf? What is that?
Yeah, you can't really see what he is. Very unusual movie. Anyways, Twisted Nightmare. The other one, Antiviral.
This is Brandon Cronenberg.
So this is Brandon Cronenberg's movie. And I might have talked about it on the show, but I just got back from set. I was up in Toronto where we were working with Kareem Hussein, who shot Antiviral. And I was talking to the crew about, you know, this film that Brandon Cronenberg did. And I have the same reaction. Every time I bring the film up, it's always met with, what is that movie? I've never heard of it. And I'm like, well, it was a film that came out in 2012. It's got Caleb Landry Jones from X-Men and Get Out. And basically, if you guys don't know, it's set like 5 minutes into the future, and Caleb Landry Jones works for a company that basically sells celebrity viruses. So if you have a cold, like say I wanted Katy Perry's cold, then they've made an agreement with Katy Perry. She sneezes on a tissue. They extract that cold, and then I can buy it, and then I can put it in my body. I can feel what Katy Perry is feeling. And I do want to feel that.
This doesn't surprise me at all that this is from the son of David Cronenberg.
No, the apple does not fall too far from the tree. So Caleb plays this guy named Sid March. And basically, he sells shit on the black market. So while he's working for this company, he's also dealing out the back door, selling stuff under the black market. And the black market takes these, like, you know, these genes and these viruses and the DNA, and they sell them to other people. But what they also do is they make celebrity meat. So they'll take a little sliver of cell tissue, and then they'll make meat that you can consume. So you can go into a meat market and go, yeah, give me some George Clooney. And they've created like a steak that's made of George Clooney's flesh. Yeah, right? It's so fucking cool.
I didn't know that was this intricate. I never saw it. I saw the poster.
It's really good. It really kind of makes you sit there and think, like, especially now. Every single time I see these news reports now about how they're trying to make like artificial meat that doesn't have to come from a cow and it's literally just meat, I think of this movie.
It's fucking crazy. And then Sarah Gadon plays this celebrity. And Sid goes to visit her to extract this virus because she's sick, but they don't know what she's sick with. So he extracts it, and then he puts it into himself because he's going to go back onto the black market. They're going to extract it from him and be able to use whatever they got. She fucking dies and from whatever she has. Hmm. And now he's like, oh, my God. What she had, I now have. So now the clock is ticking to figure out what the hell it is. You need to see it.
That sounds a bit more thrilling. Yeah, at the time I wanted to see it, but then there was something. It sounds bad, but there's something about it being his son that maybe got
– No. See it. It's really, really good. It's on Shudder right now. I put it on last week when I got back from set, and I just put it on. It's got a deliberate pace to it, so it's a little slow moving. You're at the third act, and you're waiting for escalation, but it's still kind of moving at the pace that it's been moving.
Has he made something since?
No, he hasn't. Okay. No, he hasn't. And I guess I heard through the grapevine that he's gearing up for another production. So I definitely want to see more from Brandon. But everybody, make Antiviral, put that movie on your list for this year and just check it out. Do your homework. It's great.
Eat celebrity meat.
Oh, God.
Eat a piece of George Clooney.
Speaking of eating celebrities.
Oh!
It's not nearly as good as the movie you saw.
No, but cannibalism does play a part.
So, yes, this is sort of cannibalism. Several months back, I'd done articles on cool-looking werewolves in movies just because, like I said, I love werewolves.
Hashtag all about werewolves.
All about werewolves. And one of the things that I posted, I was like, I have not seen this movie, but they look awesome, is David Hayter's 2014 Wolves. And when I posted this article and said I didn't see it, Paula Haefeli, who was a guest on our show before and a listener of the show, immediately lent it to me. And she's like, you need to watch Wolves.
Paula likes this movie?
She loves it. And more importantly, Josh Miller, who hosts Friday Night Frights and does screens with you, was like, I need to join you when you watch Wolves.
So this is Jack Nicholson.
No, Wolves. David Hayter.
I've seen this.
Yeah. Matt Curry totally. Holmes.
Matthew Curry Holmes is in it. Yeah.
I will say, it's kind of fun in parts.
I do kind of think it's fun. It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
Jason Momoa.
Lucas Till, who is in the X-Men movies and Monster Trucks, is the lead. And I mean, basically, I don't even know how to describe it because it's
like Twilighty.
It's very Twilighty,
but very trashy Twilighty. It's like Trailer Park Twilighty.
It is very problematic.
It's very WB.
Yes,
because it opens with like narration and like a football game because he's in very stylized. And basically, the main kid, he starts making out with his girlfriend in the car, and he starts to wolf out, and he's like, "Oh my god, I'm a werewolf!" And then he just wakes up randomly the next day, having murdered his parents, and is now on the run.
Yeah,
because he's a werewolf. Yeah. Then he stumbles on a town. I don't know how he got to this town, by the way. And he ends up meeting and working for Stephen McHattie, who is the lead of Pontypool.
Yeah, I love Stephen McHattie. And History of Violence opening scene.
Yes, and by sheer fate, this entire town is also a town of werewolves. Mm. So it's kind of like where he ended up coming from. And Jason Momoa. Momoa, is
Aquaman.
That his name?
Momoa.
Aquaman is the kind of the leader of this pack. And then from there, it gets pretty darn ridiculous. But I still kind of liked it.
But how ridiculous, Rob? Jason Momoa smoking a bone pipe.
I love
that's
that.
How
yes.
ridiculous.
There's a lot of wonderful decisions.
I think he does that
decisions.
In The Bad Batch, too.
Yes.
I'll tell everywhere.
I'll tell you what this movie made me do when he showed up, because he's got weird-looking eyes in it.
He's like, pretty hot in this movie.
Well, there you go, ladies.
Of course.
He's got weird-looking eyes, and I had to turn to Josh and be like, is that like what his eyes really like look like? Because he looks like that as Aquaman, and we had to like Google a photo of him to make sure he didn't have weird. He's like, no, he's got normal eyes.
I think they put contacts
in. He really likes wearing those contacts, apparently, in everything.
They were a little too glassy in this.
Yeah, I was going to say, Becca, I'm surprised. I'm surprised by you and Paula, because the whole concept is that these wolves are going to rape a girl.
Oh, no. They're raping.
Like, the promise is by the end of this film, this girl will be raped by wolves.
Like I said.
Harlequin, or is it rapey?
No, it's rapey.
They
actually say it. He's actually like, oh, no.
What's going on, guys?
He wants a purebred.
He did this in Game of Thrones, too. I mean, it's just... Jason Momoa.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that's.
I forgot that's where he started. Oh,
yeah, that was season one. I know, it's been a while.
Yeah.
But this movie, it's fun because it really did feel trashy. This felt like when I was a kid, my mom used to get these like romance horror crossover novels, and that's what it felt like I was watching.
Your mom's such a perv.
I know, right? But it really did feel like that. And I compare it to Twilight because it does have such a WB vibe, but this town that they get to, instead of it being a town of like, you know, we're werewolves, but we have a sensitive side, they're like Roadhouse gauge.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
it's totally
trashy level, like street thugs, werewolves.
It's not a great movie, but it's fun and trashy. And what I like is that they look awesome. Like,
the thing is,
they have a couple of practical suits on them, so they actually look really great.
There's a really fun insert shot with Matt Curry Holmes where they're having like their werewolf powwow, and then it cuts to him in the woods in a lawn chair going, keep an lookout tonight, and then it cuts back to the werewolves. It's great.
It's pretty funny.
And you can also see him in the Fog remake.
Yeah, so there you go.
Just because I know he's listening, and that always makes him sad when I say
that.
So, Rob,
we love
Wolves, would you recommend it?
Yeah, if you want something that's not too serious and you like werewolf stuff, absolutely. It's just a fun movie. Yeah. What it also made me realize is no matter how cool your werewolf looks, Werewolves work best when you only see them in very brief snippets. Because no matter, I mean, and I'm saying this makeup and this, that's amazing. But it gets pretty goofy when you hold on him for 2 minutes and he starts talking. It's just kind of
Go watch American Werewolf in London again. Like the little moments you see in the subway are so good.
But it's only a little bit. And you don't see him because they didn't even have a full body suit.
It's just the head of.
So yeah, now, for future Werewolf movies, less is more. That's all I got to say. Okay. But I dug it.
I think that's good advice. Yes. Except what was that crazy one we, that we had the guest, the writer on not long ago in Killer POV?
Eric Stoltz.
Yeah, but
Late Phases.
I think Late Phases, the way they show them, even though it holds quite a long time, it still was kind of effective.
That's pretty cool.
It was very practical, and that made it much better.
They're physically big, they're tall, and we've talked about this
Or at least we did on Killer POV with werewolves. The problem is that when you hold on it and it's heavily digitized, and as soon as they start talking, that's when you're like, oh, that looks off.
Maybe it's the talking thing, because again, these effects are so amazing.
I'll do it, a talking werewolf.
But after a while, when it's like, you know, I'm gonna kill you,
well, because then also it becomes
out.
True Blood. Twilight,
it's a little goofy, and you're like, but you looked so cool
too
there.
Many bad examples.
And while we were sitting here, going back to my satanic movies, I just glanced down at a strange sticker on Ryan's keyboard and suddenly went, holy shit, Ghoulies.
Oh, yeah.
Ghoulies. Satanic 80s. Yeah.
That was right in there.
I always think of Ghoulies too. That's why.
I don't think of Ghoulies at all.
How do you not think of Ghoulies?
You didn't even think of Ghoulies going to college?
No,
not at all.
No, everyone loves Ghoulies.
I grew up a Critters kid.
Oh, there we go.
Oh,
all right.
Critters.
Wait, let's take a poll. Everyone's Critters over Ghoulies here,
Ghoulies.
Right?
No, Ghoulies.
Really?
I'm so Ghoulies.
You're Ghoulies over Critters?
I am so
Critters
Ghoulies.
Is so fun.
If you're a Critters kid, you date Critters kids. If you are a Ghoulies kid, then you could date Troll kids.
What?
If you're a Troll kid, then you're just
single
for life.
Don't relegate me to the Troll kids.
Oh, are you saying that Becca dates Trolls?
Dave's a big Troll fan.
No, he would totally go Critters, to be honest.
Hierarchy when it comes to a little, and then there's the Munchkins, or what's that? Not Munchkins, Munchies.
Munchies.
Munchies kids are on Tinder.
We're the Hobgoblins.
Grinder.
No, Dave would have been. He's Critter. Actually, he's texting me right now, trying to convince
me. Ask him which one he is.
He wants me to blow off the show tonight to go see Runaway with Gene Simmons at Cine Family tonight.
Actually, Hobgoblin kids date Troll kids and Ghoulies kids. Sorry,
but the Ghoulies did look awesome.
Ghoulies
it's not a good movie.
Awesome.
But it's not a good movie.
It
Ghoulies
was great when I was
movie.
Eight.
I like
two. Yeah.
I like two.
Yeah. Okay.
I have a couple more. Did you guys see anything else?
No, that was it for me.
So then I'll go really quick with these. But because it's summertime, I had to import this from the UK because it is not available in 3D in America. But me and some friends watched Shark Night 3D.
Okay.
Which is not nearly as good as Bait 3D. But I don't remember why I didn't like this movie when it came out. I just remember being very underwhelmed by it, even though it was directed by the guy that did the second Final Destination.
Okay.
And the fourth one.
Yep.
And Snakes on a Plane.
David Ellis.
Yes,
R.I.P.
David Ellis, who sadly is no longer with us.
I really wish he was, because we'd be making some cool stuff with him.
Yeah.
Honestly, I would love to do a movie. I would have loved to have done a movie with David Ellis.
Wow.
He just seemed like fun.
I didn't see Shark Night initially in 3D, so that was part of the reason. But I was trying to remember why. But I watched it with a bunch of friends, and it's pretty ridiculous. It's actually really fun. And it definitely works for the 3D format, because basically it's a bunch of kids at college. And pretty all-star cast, like Sarah Paxton is one of them. Mm-hmm. I forget the name of the other guy, but he was in the movies with that Jacob Gentry did, the My Super Psycho Sweet 16 movies.
Mm-hmm.
But basically they're all going to where Sarah Paxton grew up, and she hasn't been there because of some odd incident that happened back at when she graduated high school. So she went to college for 2 years, and now they're going there, and one of the lead characters is going to propose to the other one. And there's a bunch of hillbilly rednecks what's his name? Why am I forgetting names? Maybe I should just have this all up. Well, one of them is Joshua Leonard from Blair Witch Project.
Yep.
But what I love about this movie, well, there's a few things. One is at the beginning, in the dorm room, one of the lead characters like breaks down the door and starts yelling at our lead character about like, you were supposed to help me like pass this test or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then he just is like, and it's a good thing I passed. It's like the weird, he's like, oh, joke's on you. And just me and Josh were just like, wow, I never saw that coming in a script. Like, what? Let's just break down the door and like threaten your friend for a joke.
Yeah.
And now we could always reference Shark Night 3D for that. But anyway, it's never happened in a movie before. but Josh Leonard in particular he is the most traditional like redneck you'd ever seen one. He's like totally racist and contradictory, but also he files his teeth into like shark teeth. So you look at him and you're like,
so dumb.
Oh, so so I guess you're one of the bad guys in this movie. Because why be subtle at all? And then there's a guy that looks exactly like Casper Van Dien, who is it's kind of hilarious. He's got a scar on his face. And then we find out that the reason that Sarah Paxton like left town is because this was her boyfriend and she accidentally sliced his face in a boating accident. Oh, and that's why she like ran away out of town. Yeah, that's who he's the sheriff.
Yeah. He's the big guy. Yeah.
Now it's kind of fun and it's cool in 3D, but what I remember is that literally for no rhyme or reason, kind of in the middle, it just gets really mean-spirited mm-hmm. and dark. And kind of goes towards the torture porn thing. And the rationale behind it is so ridiculous.
It's so good.
YouTube videos. Kind of,
that's so, no, that's
no.
So,
can we give it away? Yeah,
you just got to see it. It is fantastic and very timely.
I'm just going to say that Shark Week is the
Discovery
reason.
Discovery Shark uh-huh. Week plays okay. a heavy hand
into why everything's happening.
And I think it's fucking brilliant. I laugh so hard.
I do have to say that I was impressed, and this is purely from like a geeky, aquatic, deep sea obsessed point, but it was the first shark movie to use cookie cutter sharks. And they are the ones, they actually put a girl in a cage and then fill it with them in the movie.
Oh, right.
But they just take the way that the cookie, it's also called a cigar shark, but they take like little cookie-shaped bites because they have like round jaws, like think like a lamprey, and it's like thousands of them. And I remember thinking like, dude, you never seen that before. Well done, Shark Night. Plus it had a rap at the end, so I'll give props for a rap at
you
the end.
You know what? They actually cut because it's credits, and then at the end, I'm not even kidding. It's like a full 5-minute rap song performed by the entire cast.
Yeah, like everybody, and it
you
just
can't
goes,
believe it
shark,
exists.
Shark,
and,
shark.
And here's the thing, they cut it out of the UK one. So I feel like I have an incomplete version.
No.
I immediately went on YouTube and I was with Steve Scarlatta, who was on our Sharksploitation episode. Uh-huh. And I was like, no, this is how it's supposed to end. And you know him, he's got a very high threshold for these kind of movies. And he was highly offended. I've never seen him get more upset over showing him this rap thing. He's like, I like bad stuff, but I draw the line here. This is it. I don't want to know about the rap song. Shark Bite, it's called. You can look it up on YouTube.
I will say, you're making this sound so fun in your third dimension, but when I was in the second dimension watching this movie, I had no fun watching this.
It's a long time ago.
I just did not like this
That's
movie.
The thing.
But
it's definitely shot for that format.
And I love David Ellis,
fun.
Too. That was the other thing. I always think he's a great craftsman. Like the movies he made will always be better than they should have been.
Yeah.
He's that kind of director.
Journeyman.
But this one wasn't. This one was a bummer to go out on. But.
Well, there's one character that loses his girlfriend, I won't tell you who, but that loses his girlfriend to a shark, and then decides he's going to walk into the ocean with a spear to kill one because he's like, they took one of mine, I'm going to take one of theirs.
Such a crazy decision.
Oh, wow.
Visually.
It's amazing.
And,
so weird. Movies, man, they're crazy.
I will say, gang, that I watched Riverdale. I downloaded the pilot to Riverdale.
Love it.
On the way back.
Uh-huh.
And
are you hooked yet or what?
I am hooked.
You are.
And guess what happened when I came home?
What?
I'm like, hey, sweetie, let's get into Riverdale. She's like, oh, I watched the whole season while you were gone. I'm like, what? What? And I was like, did you like it? She goes, yeah, I thought it was pretty good. She's like, I don't like Veronica, though. And I was like, Veronica's my favorite
she's
one.
She's my favorite,
I
too.
I love Veronica. No,
this I know
great.
Me and Ryan are BFF because we both like Veronica.
Yeah, Veronica's
that's
cool.
Funny.
But no, I like the – I had no idea what to expect, but character cameos were popping up. And
Let's ask somebody who saw the whole thing because I dropped out of it about 5 or 6, and not for any reason. I just kind of was like,
They're all on Netflix now.
It started feeling a little too – I mean, I know it's kind of like Beverly Hills 90210. I've been satirizing it and kind of horror. Right. But at a certain point, I started going, or am I just watching Beverly Hills again? I wasn't sure. Does it go somewhere interesting?
Well, I think so. Yeah, no. I mean, it definitely evokes – it's trying to evoke like the whole Twin Peaks idea of like, well, who killed this one person? And it constantly shifts like who you think it is and who's involved and what people know.
I thought the writing was really strong. I thought the kids were great.
Yeah.
And the look is pretty good. I don't know who's behind it. I wanted to do my research and see who.
Same guy who created the comic book that.
Well, it was,
the zombie.
Yeah.
The zombie one.
Yep.
Afterlife.
There's a great interview with him with Elvis Mitchell, and he talks about the whole origin on the treatment.
Oh, really?
It's pretty interesting. It's like he talks about that whole where it all came from.
I have an offline story for you guys.
Okay. No.
It's cool.
And I really like, I remember when
Josie
first
and the
appeared.
Pussycat surprised me too.
Yeah, yeah.
Josie.
That's actually the best thing that I thought about it. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, I think cool they characters. Hint Sabrina at some point
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah.
I like Skeet Ulrich in it. I know like he appeared in one episode and was like, oh no.
Yeah.
But he actually turned out to be, him and like freaking Luke Perry are really good in the show. So anyway, enjoy it.
Yeah, I can't wait. Yeah.
All right, now let's get serious.
Oh, shit.
Let's get serious. We got a serious guest for a serious discussion. Straight from Chicago, baby.
Well, and isn't Chicago the town they filmed Poltergeist 3?
It is.
A movie that most of I don't know about Ryan, but the three of us loved.
Up until
I
Ryan
think
joined.
Fans of this
we
one.
Were unanimous until Ryan. It's in our introduction
Ryan,
to this
are you in
show.
Poltergeist 3?
Can somebody cue the killer POV
what?
Music just Ryan, for one more last time?
I think we need to kick Ryan out for this segment.
Well, see, what's the old, like on the old TV shows when the hook came on stage and just dragged someone off stage?
I will say in Ryan's here, defense Turek. That the director of the movie will agree with Ryan. So yes, we're actually pretty even here. All right,
well,
cool.
At least you like Dead and Buried.
I do. I love Raw Meat and I love Dead and Buried.
A hell of a guest. Gary Sherman, someone who we've always, you know, dreamed of having on, and I'm a huge, huge fan of Vice Squad, but but we're doing this because Deathline, which is not the title it's usually known as here, Raw Meat is how I discovered it. Yeah, it's exciting to see it getting remastered and playing in cinemas tonight for people in LA and on this beautiful Blue Underground
release.
Blu-ray.
Blue Underground.
All right,
let's bring him in.
All right, here we go. And again, over the course of two shows and almost 200 episodes, we say this a lot, but we really mean it here. This is a guest that we've always wanted to have on the show. And a big part of why we weren't able to is just geography, really. And in fact, we're recording this on an off time specifically to make this happen. Welcome to the show, Mr. Gary Sherman.
Thank you. Thank
Gary,
you.
Gary, I see there's bags behind you. So you literally came off the plane just to come to Shockwaves.
I did.
You did.
That's the only reason you're in LA, really. Just to come to
the main
I
reason.
Flew in just to be here. And then I'm
and we're
going to
put you back.
Back
on. Yeah, we're just going to send you back after this.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, because we obviously were big fans of all your films, but I have such a fond memory of. God, it could have been, maybe it was a decade ago at this point. But in New York City, you were previewing a film you did called 39, a film by Carol McCain, which we'll get to. But you were showing it at the Two Boots Theater. And I was doing Icons of Fright stuff at the time, and I really wanted to talk to you about it. And I think maybe Tony Timpone made the introduction.
Yeah, I remember I was at this screening.
Yeah.
And I think Tony did do the intro.
Really? You were at the 39 screening at
If it was at Two Boots, Benga was involved because I was there for like a decade. If Benga was involved and it was at Two Boots,
we didn't know each other then.
I would have been there. But yeah, Rob and I discovered that we were at a whole bunch of the screenings together at the Pioneer.
Yes. But what was cool about that night was I was used to being intro to people and then, maybe I'll get on the phone with them for 20 minutes. But you met me for pizza at Two Boots Pizza next door for like an hour beforehand, and we talked about everything, and then we went and saw the movie. And I just thought that was so cool of you, and I've always been such an admirer and fan that you put that much time and effort to talk to somebody that was just getting started at that point. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it, you know, and it's very important to me that what I think and what I do gets out to the people that are interested, and that's what it's all about. Those people that read what you do and listen to what you do are what our business is all about.
Right. And do we want to go back to the beginning?
I do. I'd love to hear.
Yeah, I want to hear how you got started in all this.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, no, start with your key question. I like the key question. I don't want to steal that.
Well, yeah. What are your – well, I always like to know – basically everybody that's a horror fan, there's a point in your young life that something scares the crap out of you and you decide you want more of that. So what was the movie or movies that your earliest horror recollections, the things that really scared you?
Vincent Price in the House of Wax, 3D.
Oh, wow.
I was like 5 years old and probably shouldn't have been taken to see that, but my brother, who was 6 or 7 years older than maybe I was 6 because he was like 12 or 13, and he took me to see The House of Wax in 3D, and I was traumatized and addicted from that point. And then in Chicago, where I lived then,
there was a program on Saturday night called Shock Theater with a character named Marvin, who had like Coke bottle glasses. And they showed, you know, old horror movies. I mean, the Frankenstein, Wolfman, and boom, boom. And I was addicted. And he wore black turtlenecks and these black glasses and boom, boom. So I started wearing black turtlenecks. And
you modeled yourself after Marvin. That's
yeah,
great.
I wanted to be Marvin.
So you wanted to be a horror host. That was your first ambition.
Yeah. And then... on a very more serious vein, when I was about 11 or 12 years old, there was a multiple murder in Chicago. There were three young boys, the Peterson-Schuessler murders, it was called. And it was three boys who disappeared, and 4 days later they found their bodies naked and mutilated in Robinson Wood in Chicago, just outside in one of the forest preserves. And the Sun-Times published a photograph of the three bodies in a ditch on the front page of the paper, which no one back then, I mean, we're talking 1956, 1957.
Sure.
Nobody published stuff like that. And I was... And they were like the same age as I was, and it really just blew me away. And I became phobic about serial killers and about things like that. And there was actually a bunch of murders in Chicago around that time, serial killer type murders. And I started having nightmares, and my brother would tease me about it, and boom, boom. And I was a very... advanced kid, you know. And everybody said to me, "Well, when you're afraid of something, learn about it. And if you learn about it, the more you know about it, the less you'll be afraid of it."
Yeah, it takes away its power a little bit.
Yeah. So I started reading, books. I mean, medical books, college books about the pathology of murder and about the pathology of especially serial killers. And what it did for me more than anything else was got me in touch with my own fears. And I started writing about it. And that's really what got me into the whole thing, because I'm very much in touch with what scares me.
Yeah.
And therefore... I'm able to scare you.
Yeah.
Did they ever catch that guy, the serial killer who left the bodies in the park?
The murders were in 1955, and he was caught in 1995.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
It's a long story, and probably...
We will research.
Well, Chicago's got a decent history of that. You got Gacy, you've got John McNaughton making Henry. You got your serial killer. You got your problems there.
We have our serial killers.
What about the filmmaking bug? Like, when was your first exposure to actually creating something yourself?
Unlike a lot of other people who I hear talking about the fact that they always wanted to be a filmmaker, I never had any... It was not... I was kind of an artist in search of a medium. And I started drawing and painting and writing and other things from the time I was tiny. And I was looking for something. Anyways, I ended up at the Institute of Design in Chicago, which is the new Bauhaus, you know, when Moholy-Nagy and Mies van der Rohe and Kepisch were thrown out of Germany by Hitler, they came to Chicago and opened the new Bauhaus, which became the Institute of Design. It's a very interesting school. And I went there to just study design. I knew I wanted something. And the thing is that at the Institute of Design, in foundation year, you study everything. And then you decide what areas you want to go to. Well, the year I was in foundation year, Aaron Siskin, who's, you know, the father of modern photography, was guest teaching at the Institute of Design. And he saw some of my photographs, and I had never shot a photograph before then, but you had to shoot photographs. So Aaron saw my photographs and said, "Would you like to be one of my students?" And so here's the father of modern photography saying to me, "You want to be one of my..." So I wasn't going to say no. So I switched my major to photography.
Huh. What do you think he saw in it?
He admitted later he saw himself in my photographs. He thought that my aesthetics were very close to his aesthetics. And as I advanced through school, I found a movie camera. I found a 16-millimeter Aeroflex in a closet, a World War II 16-millimeter Aeroflex that had just been sitting there. And I said to Aaron, "Can I shoot something with this camera?" And he says, "Well, I'm still going to judge it as photographs. I don't care what you're doing." In the meantime, at the time, I was working my way through school, and I was working at Chess Record Company as a session musician. I sang, which happened because I had a group, and we cut at Chess, and the guys in the booth thought they liked what they heard, and then they found out I read music, and they said, "Well, your group's not going to go anywhere, but if you want some session work, come back." And so anyway, I started recording there, and one of the people I was singing background for was Bo Diddley. And wow.
What songs?
It was his Bo Diddley Go-Go album.
Wow.
This was when Bo was kind of another comeback. Mm-hmm. He'd already been Bo Diddley, and he wanted to be Bo Diddley again.
Which would explain your documentary on Bo Diddley.
Yeah, it would explain my documentary. So anyhow, I'm recording with him, and I'm doing backups, and one of the backup singers I was working with, may she rest in peace, was Minnie Riperton. Minnie and I were great friends. I miss her. And so I said to Bo, I said, "Do you mind if I shoot some footage of you?" And he said, "Oh yeah, I love getting my picture taken, so whatever you want." He said, "But you better ask Ron." So I asked Ron Malo, who is the head engineer, if I could do it. And Ron said, "Just stay out of the vocal booth, because the rest of the studio, they make so much noise, nobody will ever hear you anyway." So I brought this 16-millimeter Aeroflex into the studio and shot Bo Diddley recording. And Marshall Chess, who was Phil Chess, Lenny Chess's son, the two Chess brothers were Phil and Lenny. And Marshall comes walking in and says, "Sherman, what are you doing?" I said, "Oh, this is for school." He says, "I want to see it." So I said, "Okay." So a couple of days later, I bring a 16-millimeter Filmo sound projector under my arm and walk into his office and throw the footage up on the wall. And he says, "I love this stuff." And he calls everybody in. And everybody starts looking. I said, "Never seen anything like this. This is great. Let's make a movie." I said, "I don't know how to make a movie. I know how to shoot pictures." He said, "I'll hire everybody." And he hired a whole crew for me, and I ended up going on the road with Bo Diddley, and we shot The Legend of Bo Diddley, which ended up getting sold to 75 television stations around the world. And
wow. Just throwing
it. Not a bad first film to have.
And then record companies started calling me and asking me to shoot their artists.
Mm-hmm. That's insane.
And that's how it all
started.
All right,
started.
So that opens the door. I mean, how do you segue from this rich music world and this great background into Raw Meat?
Or Deathline.
Deathline.
Or AKA, I like to call it Raw Meat. It's so seedy a title. I love it.
I know. It is seedy. I've argued with like everybody about that.
Well, also, how does an American, in Chicago end up in England? Like, that's the – I guess I never even put it together that the same person who made Raw Meat when I started a long time ago as Raw Meat was the person who had made these other movies I loved. You know, they just didn't connect because I assumed it was a British filmmaker.
Yeah, I always thought it was a British film.
Yeah, everybody did. Well – The music films took me into commercials. I started getting calls from advertising agencies, and Everybody wanted to be hipper than everybody else, so they wanted to use this guy who was making all these music films. So I was doing that, and then along came a little convention in Chicago in 1968.
Uh-huh. Medium cool.
Yes. And I wasn't a filmmaker filming Medium Cool. Yeah. I was one of the people out on the street, and yeah. I was an organizer, and I got arrested a few times, and boom, boom. And then Nixon got elected, and I said, I do not want to live in this country under these circumstances. My mother is British, and I went to England and claimed status because of the fact that my mother was British, and I was granted a green card. And I had a film I had done for PBS, well, it was NET back then, PBS Today, had just won an Emmy. And so based on the fact that I had, you know, a film I did had just won an Emmy, I was granted artist status and given a working permit. Hmm. And started doing commercials. So I'm doing commercials, and my commercial producer is, I'm going to get very sad for a moment, was a friend of mine from New York named Jonathan Demme.
Oh, yeah.
And Jonathan at that time had no want to direct. He was producing commercials, mm-hmm. and we were together in a commercial company. And actually, the company was owned by Robin Hardy.
Oh, wow. Wicker Man director.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jeez. What a cast of...
So, and... So anyways, Jonathan was producing me, and we were doing this stuff. And we also did some business with Michael Mann. Michael Mann wanted to do a company with Jonathan and myself, and...
So he was Chicago-based, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was from Chicago. Yeah.
What was Michael like back then?
Michael is no different than he's ever. Michael, am I allowed to swear?
Absolutely.
Of course.
Michael's an asshole. And Michael is, and you know what? In my life, I love everybody. I try not to make enemies. Michael and my ex-wife, one of my ex-wives, uh-oh. Are the only two people I will say bad things about. he's an awful human being.
Wow.
And so Jonathan never even wanted to talk about knowing Michael after the experience that we had. But anyways, John and I went on and were working, you know, with other people and doing our thing. And everybody kept saying to me, you should direct a feature, because everybody in the commercial business in London was starting to do features. And everybody said, do a feature. And I said, how do you do a feature? And they said, write a script. So we're doing this huge budget Procter & Gamble commercial. Mm. The agency producer was a guy named Kerry Jones, who had just written a novel and was a good friend of mine. We'd worked together before, and he had hired me for this big budget commercial, which actually the budget on that commercial was about three times the budget on Deathline when we get there.
Wow.
And
I think that's still the case with a lot of commercials versus film.
You're probably right. And so anyways... I had this idea, which I had been, I read a lot, I write a lot, and I research a lot. And I had gotten interested in how the tubes began. I had heard about the legend of Siri Bean, who was a highwayman turned cannibal in mm-hmm. Scotland, and I eat that kind of stuff.
Great article about that on Blumhouse.com in reference to The Hills Have Eyes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm. Well, so I took that and then the Donner Pass thing and everything, and I'm thinking about it all. And aside from the fact that Jonathan and I, and I had done it with other people too, had written a number of scripts that we were never able to sell, because all of my scripts were very political. I'm I am a political. I mean, I left the country because of politics.
Now, of all things.
Yeah, really. A lot of us
don't
want to
leave. I don't know why I'm
yeah,
here.
Yeah,
right
this has got to be worse than next.
Don't leave us.
I was going to leave.
Stay with the rest of us.
I actually had said to people that I was going to leave, but I. And I still might.
Just not till after the interview.
Okay. But I mean, I hate what's going on right now. Yeah. But so, anyways. None of my political scripts sold. And I thought, and somebody, John Daly, actually, from the Hemdale Company, said to me, write a horror script. That she'll sell. And I thought, wow, how I could hide a political message inside a horror script and nobody would ever know.
Nice.
Yep.
And I was really reacting because I had been my dad was involved in civil rights his whole life, and I was raised in a very colorblind home, and I got to England and everybody in England talked about racism in America, where I'm living in a society there that is as class conscious, and the classism there so far outweighs what our racism is here.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, somebody's got to say something about that. And so that's what I did. I wrote the script and made the monster the sympathetic character because he wasn't responsible for what he did. Society was responsible for his actual existence. And and it was, I'm not really sure that I realized how different that was when I wrote it. I wasn't trying to write something different. I was trying to write something that just made a point. And I wanted performances and I wanted real characters. And
speaking of the performers, look at the two. You got them one scene together. As a young person, when I finally saw that movie, I remember being pretty blown away to see Donald Pleasance and Chris Lee, you know, kind of squaring off there. And it's quite funny. It reminds me of and Frenzy. Frenzy's quite an intense movie, but then it has these comic scenes between the husband and wife. And I felt kind of similar, the little comic, you know, exchange between them.
And in Frenzy, it was Clive Swift who plays
he's in it too,
the London transport cop in Deathline.
Mm-hmm. Right,
he had just finished Frenzy when I cast him in Deathline.
How funny.
But it was Donald that brought everybody to the movie. I mean, as people have said, I had the audacity to go after Donald Pleasance. And at that time, Donald Pleasance was the actor's actor.
He's a Harold Pinter actor at that point.
Yeah,
right?
He was, you know, he had more awards and, you know, British Academy Awards and Tonys. He was doing Man in the Glass Booth on Broadway when I had the idea of casting him, and he had just won a Tony for it. And everybody says to me, he's not going to do it. And I said, let's go after him. And, you know, and I had Jay Cantor as my executive producer who, you know, was like every agent in the world wanted to be Jay Cantor. And so Jay could call any agent in the world and say, so Jay calls Donald's agent and says, you know, I have this young director that's making a movie for us and he wants to get this script to Donald. And he claims that he's heard that Donald wants to do a comedy. And if you take just the Cahoon character out of Deathline, it's pure comedy. And I said this to his agent, and she said, okay. She sends it to Donald in New York. I get on a plane. I go to New York. And I said, I want to talk to him. And he agreed to have dinner with me. And doo-doop, he said, I love it, and I want to do a comedy. He says, I'm not going to think about the other parts of the script because that doesn't have anything to do with the part that I'm playing.
I almost feel like the levity that is brought to the role and what is demonstrated kind of informed the American Werewolf and London Investigators a little bit.
Yeah.
If you watch them back to back, you're like, oh yeah, Landis definitely is.
John does not deny that he was influenced by.
I bet.
Interesting.
Take, I was going to say, just take us on the day of the Cushing Pleasance moment. Like, to me, that like you said, I was completely blown away.
Yeah, surprising.
And the stories, and I never get to hear enough of those stories about what went down between those two and what it was like.
Well, Christopher was good friends with Paul Maslansky. And Christopher said, "What are you doing, Paul?" And Paul said, "Well, I'm doing this film with this young director who's had the audacity to get Donald Pleasance to be in it." Christopher says, "Where's my part?" And Paul says, "Our budget is less than you get paid to do a movie." And he says, "I want to work with Donald Pleasance."
Wow.
Yeah.
"If you'll write me a one-on-one scene with Donald Pleasance and I don't have to wear fangs, I'll do it for scale."
Wow. Nice.
So that's what we did. And I then realized, oh my God, I'm going to have Donald Pleasance and Christopher Lee in a room with me, a 20-something-year-old director who's never directed a film before. And I have another problem. Christopher's like a foot and a half taller than Donald.
That's true. He towers above.
And am I answering your question?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I said Cushing, not Lee, which is my bad. But no, I mean, just like
we knew what you meant.
Yeah, you know, everybody knows what I mean. But no, I'm just it reminded me of a similar scenario. Your friend Michael Mann, when he brought Al Pacino and De Niro together, you know, and it's just one of those powerhouse moments.
Two titans.
The one and only time I think they ever got to work together.
Yeah,
right?
It
they
is.
Never did a film together before or after.
And it was all Christopher wanted to do a scene with, and we wrote it for the two of them.
Right,
I mean,
right.
It was, but then shooting it.
So wait a minute. So you got notes from Pleasance and Lee, like on the. Did they come to you and go, "Well, I probably wouldn't have said this, but I'll change this"?
Not really.
No,
I mean, they just kind of accepted
Carrie and
their
I
roles.
Wrote it.
Really,
and they looked at it and they
just made it their own. And
actor, actors,
wow.
They just do what they're told. Yeah. They're professionals. I love it.
You know, and then
I don't know what I would do. If
yeah,
came
now
like,
the problem was I didn't want Donald looking up at the ceiling
and Christopher
looking down at the floor.
Right.
So that's when I came up with the idea of shooting them in singles and having them look straight into the camera and move. I had the camera set at Christopher's eye height and had him looking straight into camera, and then camera set at Donald's eye height and having Donald. So it looks like they're looking straight at each other, but there's like 18 inches difference in their height.
And I remember when I first talked to you about it, and I didn't notice it until you pointed it out, was you were saying, I think it starts in close-ups on who is the more dominant personality
right,
in the
it
conversation.
Starts in close-ups on Donald.
Right, and as Christopher Lee takes over, you zoom in closer to him.
Mm-hmm.
So subtly, you it's the way of showing
we had
who's
the camera
more
on a dolly, and started on Donald, and every line we pulled back. And it was measured out as to how that was going to work with the two of them. And pull back, and pull back, and pull back, and pull back. And on Christopher, we started wide, and every line we pushed in.
Yeah.
And they're never on camera together until Christopher sits down. And then once Christopher was sitting down, I could do two shots.
Yeah. You worked that out.
Now talk a little bit more about the filming, specifically what it was like shooting in the subways and how you worked some of those shots. And
was this all practical?
It
like
was
locations?
All real locations.
Did
it
you
was all
shut
abandoned.
The subways down?
No.
Oh, they were abandoned.
All this stuff, we only shot one day in a real underground station, and that's the Aldwych station in the city, which at that time was closed on Sunday. And we had the station on a Sunday. And there's only a couple of scenes where you actually see a real train. It's only when you see the train that we're shooting in an actual tube station. The rest of the time, there's over 500 miles of abandoned tube tunnel under London.
Wow. Wow.
Which is talked about in the film because those tunnels were dug by competing companies, and then many of them never even got used. Some of them were used as storage areas during the war for ammunition and munitions and air raid shelters.
Hmm.
But there's as I said, 500. So we were down in the abandoned tunnels and had to move a lot of homeless people out of there who we actually had them moved and paid for them to have a place to stay.
Found I was going to say, you became part of the problem if you're just kicking all these homeless people out of their homes.
We didn't do that at all. We hired some of them to help us clean up the area and and then we made it nicer for them when they moved back in.
Oh, good. Good, good, good.
So we did take care of everybody. But the smell down there,
oof.
It's 45 years later, I can still smell what it smelled like down
there. That's like what you hear about Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I've heard that same thing where they
never forget.
Where they tried to burn all the meat, but the smell just stayed
the
for the rest of the
dinner scene where everything was rotting on the table.
Yeah, very visceral. Yeah.
Well, you know, we couldn't afford to have some special effects person make up all those dead bodies and the hanging meat. So we used real meat.
Yeah.
And that meat was hanging there all the time we were shooting. So every day it smelled worse and worse. Uh-huh. And then we brought the maggots in and introduced the maggots into the meat.
Oh, wow.
And then we had the rats.
Oh, Jesus.
And, so those were real rats.
Those were real rats. We had some trained rats, but there were a bunch of not trained rats. We had rats around all the time.
Wow. They were just like hanging out and you were like, shoot that rat.
Yeah, but, you know, when we did this scene.
Not like with a BB gun, like with the camera, like shoot the rat.
Shoot the rat.
Delving into Becca's psyche here.
Capture the rat film.
The rat in its natural habitat.
Film the rat.
Film the rat. But, you know, like in that scene where the man's running around and biting off heads and stuff, those were our trained rats.
Huh.
And some, then we brought some dead rats in that we found around. There were a lot of dead rats around.
Wow, you play like you brought them onto set and everything.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's how you get plague, sir.
Yeah.
Talk briefly about the score. There's an opening theme to this movie that when I saw the film in high school, there was no internet. There was nothing like that. I could just only go to like Tower Records and go, excuse me, but do you have the Raw Meat soundtrack? And they go, what, kid? I just love the seediness because you literally have this, this man of power walking through these seedy streets, past porno shops, past all that, and this music is just driving him along, and it was so catchy.
I have the record of this. I showed him, and you didn't realize it was on vinyl.
Well, yeah. I Will Malone is quite well known in England.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, on Trailers from Hell, Dante's website, Edgar Wright does the introduction for Deathline, and in the middle of the whole thing, he starts talking about Will Malone and what a fan he is of Will Malone, and I mean, Will Malone's gone on to do a lot of stuff. He's produced Coldplay. He's he had a group called Orange.
I just imagine
the guy who did Deathline produced Coldplay.
I'm just imagining him introducing the theme music for this film to the guys from Coldplay. No, I want a little more like Deathline.
A little more Deathline in there.
Make it really skeezy. You want to take a shower after this.
It's really funny.
It's a damn fine theme.
But he had a group called Orange Bicycle, which was like a real kind of alternative rock group. And I was given a free hand, and I was into music, and I loved the stuff that Will was doing. Jeremy Rose, who I hired to kind of be the music coordinator on the picture, was a guy I had done a lot of commercials with, and actually we had just done a commercial, and he had brought in Manfred Mann to do the track, and I couldn't afford Manfred Mann to do the movie. And I said to him, I want somebody who's... Manfred was pretty far out back then. And I said, you know who... And he says, oh, Will Malone. We'll bring you Will Malone. Hmm. And I met Will and listened to his music and said, get crazy.
Wow.
I would say he did that.
What happened on the back end and in terms of like the different names, and did the distribution go well initially when the film first came out, and then was it when it came to America that the title changed? How did
happen? The film opened unbelievably in Europe. In the UK, it was what they called an Edie Plan picture, which was a tax thing. And with Edie, depending on how big the box office was how much Edie you were paid back. And the maximum was double Edie. And usually it took a picture a month or 2 months, because back then it wasn't like it is today, where a picture opens and closes and has to make money in the first week. But with Deathline, it went double Edie within the first week and a half. And it was just, there were lines around the block.
Now, was it perceived as being more of a social issue and more political? There, like, did people kind of, was
did
it still
pick up on what you were? Yeah,
did they get it? What you were?
I some did. I mean, you know, Robin Wood, who was a very prominent critic at the time, he picked up on it completely. There were several. There was an there was a review in the London Times and in the Financial Times that they really got what it was about. The more average papers just actually some of them the reviews were everything from glowing to scathing. Actually, they were glowing and scathing with very little in between.
That's horror film too. That's what happens.
The Daily Mail had the rank organization should be ashamed of themselves was the headline of the review. And I think that sold more tickets than the good reviews, if you want to know the truth.
Nicholas Rogue took the Rank, where Rank gave, I think their reaction to Bad Timing was, this is the most disgusting film ever committed to celluloid. And then they took that quote and put it on their poster, even though it was the company that funded the movie and hated it. And I'm like, now that's how you do it.
Well, you know, it was weird. It was opened, Rank was nervous about the film. And they opened it on the second half of a double bill with another movie. And what happened was that within 2 or 3 days, nobody was going to see the other movie, and there were lines of people waiting to go see Deathline. So the theater started pulling the other movie and running Deathline twice as often.
And that's amazing, because the first film was Chariots of Fire. Remarkable double feature. If you haven't done it, try it at home.
Well, it was a picture called Night Hair Child.
Oh, well, there you go.
Not Chariots of Fire.
Not Chariots of Fire.
All right, I'll take
same
it.
Producers of You know, Jay and Laddie produced Chariots of Fire.
It's a broad,
so,
broad stroke.
You know, it was a Ladd Company film, as was Deathline.
So, but I imagine it didn't obviously get the same exposure here in America at the time.
Well, what happened was Frank Yablans was president of Paramount at the time. Frank was in London, and David Niven Jr. was running CIC, which was the Paramount Universal co-production or co-distribution company in Europe. And David had seen the film and really liked it. And he told Frank about it and asked Frank to come see it. So he and Frank screened it. And at the point when the man grabs Sharon on the platform, they both jumped. Frank jumped to the right. David jumped to the left. They knocked their heads together.
Oh, wow.
And so they called and said, David's assistant called and said, as soon as their headaches go away, they're going to call you, but they love the movie and they want to make an offer. So we were really excited. We were Jay and Laddie and Paul and I were sitting in the office waiting for this phone call. So we pick up the phone, we call the people in New York who had financed the film and said, we've sold the film worldwide to Paramount. We're going to make a deal with them tomorrow. And they said, it's too late. So what do you mean it's too late? They said, we just sold it to AIP. At which point, Jesus. I took out a razor blade and slit my wrists. And And then it ended up that they sold it to AIP on a cross-collateralization thing, because they had some other pictures that they had done with AIP that had gone into the toilet. And we were stuck. And we said, no, Paramount wants the picture worldwide, except for the UK, which Rank had the UK. And they said, it's too late. And we didn't know about the cross-collateralization. That's why it was too late. So Samuel Ziarkov gets his hands on the picture. And
Look up some quotes by Sam Ziarkov and you'll get a feeling for why this film is no longer in good hands. Well, he knows he does trash.
Samuel Ziarkov comes to London and calls me, and he's staying at this suite at the Savoy. And he says, come and see me. So I went and saw him. He answers the door in a silk smoking jacket with a big SZA monogram.
Oh, that sounds so Sam Arkoff.
With a cigar that's about the size of a small baseball bat.
That's nice. So great.
And I go in, I start talking to him, and he says, why do you want to do pictures with people like Alan Ladd and Jay Cantor? They don't know anything about making movies. And he goes on and he starts bad-mouthing him, and I said, Sam, this was a nice conversation.
Yeah.
Fuck off. And I left because, I mean, I love Jay and Letty. Yeah. And they've been very, very good to me over the years. And so, you know, ba-boom.
Producers were big personalities back in the day.
Yeah.
Then,
I mean, like Sam, yeah.
Castle, they all like,
all of them,
yeah.
All of them. Big personalities. Yeah. It's amazing.
Well, I would have rather worked with William Castle than Sam Arkoff.
Yeah.
But anyway, so then we didn't even know when they were releasing it. And when they released Raw Meat and we saw the ads on Raw Meat, we didn't even know Raw Meat was Deathline.
Mm.
And then it was Robin Wood who was writing for the Village Voice as well as, you know, for the papers that he wrote for in England, who published an article called Butchered in the Village Voice. And he said, Butchered is what AIP has done to a picture called Deathline, and they turned it into Raw Meat. And don't go see Raw Meat because it's not Deathline.
Mm.
Wait till you can see Deathline, because Deathline's a great picture and Raw Meat's a piece of shit.
And they'll be waiting till now.
And they had to wait 45 years.
That's crazy. Isn't that crazy? Wow.
I will say the one sheet that they made for Raw Meat is pretty striking.
It's striking.
There's a shop in Burbank that has one that I just keep eyeballing every time I go. It's just a striking piece of art, even if it's just a little.
That's all the kind of zombie
you
woman.
You know what? That in no way is in the movie, but it's actually some decent art.
There is a script. There is like an actual publicity shot behind the art.
Yeah, but the rest of it looks it looks like a cult cannibal film.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's absolutely.
It's like Rob Zombie and his minions.
I mean, it had nothing to do with the movie.
It does totally look like a Rob Zombie.
Did you quickly go into your try to get into another movie to kind of take your mind off that, you know, the that side of it with Dead and Buried, or did Dead and Buried take a long time?
I did the opposite.
Okay.
I didn't want to make another movie.
Oh, wow.
I had made this movie, which was a big hit in Europe, but when it went back to my home, it disappeared, and I was really upset about it. I had a very successful commercial career going, and I just said, you know what? I'll just keep making commercials. My heart was broken when Deathline was turned into Raw Meat. And I just said, if that's the way people are going to treat it, I don't want to do that. Nope, they don't do that to my commercials. Uh-huh. Why should I submit myself to this? And I didn't. And it wasn't until Ron Shusett came banging on my door one day and said, I'm the world's biggest fan of Deathline and I want you to make a movie with me. And he brought me Dead and Buried. And
didn't he write something else interesting? Some little movie?
What was that?
He's written
that
a lot
movie?
Of
stuff. No, I'm kidding. Alien.
He's a Shusett.
You had told me off record that, well, when we talked on the phone, that you were maybe up for Alien.
I was up for Alien.
Yeah.
Wow.
But there was Ronnie wanted me to do Alien, and Jay and Laddie were considering me for Alien because they were the president and vice president or executive vice president of Fox then. Gordon Carroll, who was one of the producers, was basically pushing for Walter Hill to direct it. And to tell you the truth, I really love and respect Walter Hill, and I wasn't ready to get into a one-on-one battle with Walter. Mm. Then when Walter dropped out of it because of Driver, which was funny because now people look at Driver on a whole different level.
Yeah.
At the time,
it's one of his best.
It was a big failure for him at the time.
It was a big failure, and Fox was afraid to let him do the picture.
Well, he said in some interviews lately that he was also a little intimidated by the effects. He didn't know if he could pull off the effects in Alien. Like, he hadn't made that kind of movie.
Right.
I mean, he and David Giler did the final draft of it, and they did a wonderful
job. Yeah, on the script.
Brilliant script. Walter is one of my heroes. I mean,
absolutely. Mine too.
And...
So I was going to say, what struck you about Dead and Buried that made you want to take on that in the wake of what had happened on Deathline?
Dead and Buried felt there's a political message that I was able to put into
smuggle
Dead
into
and
the
Buried.
Main picture. Yeah.
Of totalitarianism, of of manipulation of human beings, and the original script and what Ron and I took from the original script that Ron brought me, and Ron and I worked on the script extensively for a while, we really honed the comedy. It was really funny when it was funny, and it was really dark when it was dark.
Right.
And so I said, you know, and we went to do it, and we made the movie, and unfortunately, you can listen to the commentary. Three different production companies are involved in the film. Now, Avco Embassy was going to be the distributor, but they weren't the producer. They were just the distributor. It started out to be Guinness with Richard St. John running the Guinness company. He was great. They were going to make the movie that Ronnie and I wanted to make. Then Guinness dropped out of the film business, and it was bought by a company called Aspen Productions, which was John Hyde. And John basically was going along with what we wanted to do, and we were making the picture that we wanted to make. Then Mark Damon steps in, who was running PSO at the time, and buys Aspen Productions. We have a screening of my cut of the film, which Bob Ramey, who was president of Avco at the time, hugs me after the screening and says, "This is brilliant. I love this movie." And everybody else was really happy with it. Mark Damon comes and puts his arm around my shoulder and takes me into a corner of the theater and says, "Okay, if I wanted Bergman to direct a horror film, I would have hired Bergman. So now turn this into a horror picture."
Oh, geez.
And ba-boom. Anyways, the rest is history. I changed a few things for them. It wasn't enough for them.
Right.
Bob Ramey was very protective of me because he really liked the picture. Bob Ramey tried to sue them to not change the movie. Mm. It didn't work because the studio did not have that power over them. Jay Cantor, who'd always been my mentor, said to me, "Walk away. Don't get involved in this. There's going to be lawsuits. Just walk away. Start your next picture." And he called Bob Ramey, and he said, "Don't put Gary in a position where he's got to be in the middle of this." And Bob Ramey says, "Okay, and in fact, I want Gary to do another picture for me right away." So Bob called me. I went into the studio, and Bob puts a pile of scripts on the desk and says, "Here, go home, read these, pick one."
Right.
"And let's do it."
And then you're at home, depressed in boxer shorts, watching Young and the Restless, and you're like, "That guy is going to play a white pimp." And that's the exact story, right?
There's a week in between there.
Right? Before we get to it, though, before we get to the thing I'm most excited to talk about, but the funny thing is did the elements for your cut, could they still exist? Is there any way to...
They destroyed my cutting copy.
Yeah. Oh, okay. No.
And at that time, there was no videotape. We didn't videotape anything. They destroyed my cutting copy so that I couldn't go back and put the film back together.
And the weird thing about cinema, I guess, because your experience is I imagine you can never fully love Dead and Buried because of that. I mean, the film that exists now.
You will always see 90%
of my Dead and Buried is there.
Yeah.
And there's 10% that's added in. It's not that they changed what I did. They put in other scenes that
okay.
I didn't want.
Okay, gotcha, to make it a little more hard. And yet, that's of all the genre movies I can think of like movies that are lesser known, like horror films, that one's never failed to be the kind of – it's like the definitive cult horror movie that you could give to somebody who's looking for a horror film they haven't seen. And I've never heard somebody come back and not have loved it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's like that perfect gem of that kind of movie. But I know from your perspective it's different. But as a viewer
– I love Dead and Buried.
Okay, good.
I mean, I absolutely adore that movie. I just hate the scenes that, they put in with special effects, not – you know, not by Stan.
Yeah.
Because Stan didn't want to go back in and do that stuff over again. He called me and, you know, said, you don't want to do this, do you? I said, no, I don't want to do it. He said, then I won't do it because they can't make me do it. They might be able to make you do it, but they can't make me do it and I won't do it. And they hired some, I don't even remember who the special effect, the acid in the nose.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the worst special effects I have ever seen.
Yeah.
I don't even remember who did that. And
I'm sure that guy's a listener.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Cursing you now.
He actually, him and Michael Mann often do listen. Let's be honest.
Yeah, they're our biggest.
I was going to say, it's because of Stan's involvement that sent me down the rabbit hole. Because of Stan's involvement, I saw Dead and Buried. And then because of Dead and Buried and you, I was like, oh, what's Deathline? And I just kept going back. And then I was like, oh, Poltergeist 3.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure you guys want to talk about.
Well, we'll get there. We'll get there.
But I just want to know.
I wanted to ask about the box cover for Dead and Buried. Because that's one of the ones that I look back at, like what struck me on video store shelves in the 80s that I was like, okay, I have to see this based on cover alone.
Yeah.
And that's when I first rented Dead and Buried. So how did that art come to be?
Ronnie? That was absolutely Ron Shusett. Ron Shusett was so blown away working with Giger on Alien. And Giger pointed him to this artist.
Oh. It is a gorgeous piece of art.
Who ended up doing the piece. And Ronnie brought me an early sketch, and I went, fuck yes. That's unbelievable. I mean, I have 85 Dead and Buried posters, different sizes and stuff hanging all over my house. Just not because it's Dead and Buried, but I love that piece of artwork.
It's so striking. I remember it terrifying me on video store shelves till I finally got up enough nerve to rent it. And then I love the movie, of course, but it was that art that did it for me.
Well, it's a film with layers, and it's a film that has surprises to still reveal. And I think a lot of – because it starts out so kind of nasty, and you think, oh, is this like a slasher-type movie? Yeah. And it slowly reveals itself to be a really smart, clever, dark tale, which I think is kind of rare in that period. I think it really stands the test of time nicely.
Because we haven't seen anything since then. Sorry, Rob.
I was just going to say, I really wish that somebody would give Dead and Buried the exact same treatment that this wonderful Deathline Blu-ray has. Is that possible, Gary?
Can we have such a gift?
Right now, as we sit here in Los Angeles, in London, England, the original negative of Dead and Buried is passing itself through a 4K scan.
Yes.
Boom.
And we are going to restore completely Dead and Buried and do some extras that'll blow people away.
And who's responsible for this?
None other than Bill Lustig.
Of course it's Bless Bill him.
You mean
Lustig.
That director of Maniac Cop?
That
what?
Director of Maniac
That guy?
Yep. Awesome.
He is awesome.
So any clue when Blue Underground will be I'm sure you guys don't have dates on this yet, I would think.
Bill initially was talking about Christmas, but it ain't going to happen because as they're doing the 4K scan in England, there was a problem with the scanner and they're waiting for parts to show up from Italy. So the scan is going to get delayed. And I just came from a meeting with Bill. We were going to try and do the timing and shoot the extras and stuff in August. And we're going to do it in November. So it's like 3 months.
But 2018, for sure.
Yeah, so it's early 2018.
But don't rush them, because it's going to be awesome. But you got to
just don't mess with the cover art.
Awesome takes time.
Yeah, no.
Don't mess with your cover art.
Yeah.
No, we won't
go with that original cover art.
Maybe you can have a reverse of something else for fun, but that is perfect. Okay, so back to you, depressed, on a couch, watching Human Nature. Now, can you talk me through, like, I'm not kidding. This people who have been listening know I have been talking about Vice Squad since before it became cool again, because this was a movie I happened to see at a video store in Chicago, and I was working at Facets that you probably know in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
So I worked there for a couple of years, and I came across this film. I'd
with
never heard of it. Yeah, he runs it. And that movie, I'd never seen a performance quite like that. I mean, I guess, you know, Jack Nicholson in The Shining is doing this kind of elevated thing, but with what Wings is doing, it feels like it's coming from this real place. It feels so intense, him playing this white pimp. And, you know, I looked him up, and he hadn't really done anything except Young and the Restless. So my brain can't understand how this movie came to be and how he was in it.
Wings Hauser was married to Nancy Locke at the time. Nancy Locke is the mother of the little boy in Dead and Buried, in the haunted house scene.
Oh, so you already were associated with the family a bit.
So Wings was up in Mendocino with us as the husband of Nancy. And Wings and I got to be friends. And he played guitar, and I play and sing. And so we used to play and sing and little hootenanny. And I got to know Wings pretty well. And I very quickly learned that Wings Hauser was not Greg Foster, the character that he played in The Young and Restless, the world's nicest person. Wings had a lot of darkness in his life. And I felt that darkness needed cultivating, because he was going to explode if he didn't have an exit for that darkness. And I started working with him on it. And I just was playing scenes with him even before we talked about Vice Squad, because I knew that Wings had a much greater range than Greg Foster in The Young and Restless was ever able to give. And I found the dark side.
Did you ever?
In Wings. That was unbelievable.
Yeah.
So now I go back to the studio and said to the studio, I found who I want to play Ramrod. And they said, who? And I said, Wings Hauser. And they all looked at me and said, Greg Foster? And I said, yeah, but it won't be Greg Foster. And they said, forget about it. Forget about it. It ain't going to happen. Forget about it. So I said to them, can I bring him in to read for you? And they said, yeah, okay. So I go in to the studio with Wings, and Wings and I had really rehearsed this.
Oh, I love it.
And so I'm in there, Bob Ramey's sitting behind the desk, and Frank Capra Jr., who was there, and a few other executives from Avco, and they're just sitting there, and Wings comes in and just looks at everybody. He says, in a voice they had to lean forward to hear him, he says, I hear you fucking people don't want me in this movie. He says, who? He points at Raimi and he says, who the fuck are you? You're like the big guy here. And he walks up to him across the table, and he reaches over and he grabs him by the tie.
Whoa.
And he pulls him across the table, and he gets right into his face and says, you're the one who's stopping me from being who I want to be, aren't you?
Wow, Ramrod was born in that moment.
And it was unbelievable. And Raimi
pulls back a little bit, looks at me and says, okay.
Oh, man. Every actor is going to try this now, and it's not going to work out.
It's not going to work out. Don't threaten the Hollywood execs,
guys. It's just
going
to be assault.
Was that hard to maintain, like, once he's doing this? Because, like, I mean, I always imagine the guys who play villains, that's tough. Like, you know, to keep that up for the whole shoot. Was he a handful? Was he the same guy you knew before? Did he change?
He made me promise. You know, we only shot at night on Vice Squad. And we'd wrap at about 5 o'clock in the morning. And I would take – Wings made me promise that I wouldn't let him go home to Nancy and the kids.
As Ramrod.
As Ramrod. Yeah. And so I used to have to take Wings out drinking at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, Jesus.
And we'd go to bars and we'd sit there until he was back to being Wings and not Ramrod anymore.
Wow.
And I did that every morning when we finished shooting.
Oh, man.
But I would think drinking would just further enhance.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it would mellow him out.
It mellowed the Wings.
Yeah.
So with Vice Squad, it's still not available on Blu. We'll hope one day that happens. But even the DVD hasn't been the easiest find. But if you can track it down, people, that is our big recommendation for this week. That is a movie you will not regret. I imagine that's a movie you're super proud of because it's amazing.
It's my favorite. And it is my movie. It was the one movie that didn't get changed. What's in that movie is my movie.
Well, the ugliness of it is, I think, the thing. Like, it feels as ugly as that world probably really is. Like, that's probably a really scary place to be.
That's what I wanted to do. Yeah. I mean, that film is about violence against women and the exploitation of women. And that's why I made that picture, is just to point a finger at that world and this whole sex for money world, which is a pretty awful.
Which is still an awful, big problem in the world right now.
Yeah.
So we can't let this go. I know we're running out of time. Poltergeist 3 is, listeners of this show, and we told you a second ago, we had a previous incarnation of the show where we did how many? 140 episodes.
Yeah.
Yep. And we have very different tastes, and yet one of the only sequel that we all, for whatever reason, love is Poltergeist 3. This is long before Scream Factory put it out again, and I even revisited it this year wondering if I was wrong, like, because I hadn't seen it in 15 years. And just still being stunned by some of the optical work, the trick camera effects, the mirrored images. I think, as a magician level, I love this movie still.
It's all live.
The production design.
Yeah.
It's shocking.
Well, Paul Eads is a brilliant production designer. And we had an amazing time making that film. And I wanted it to be the last major movie that was made without any CGI in it.
Mm.
I had done a film very early in CGI, maybe one of the first television movies that ever used CGI, which is The Mysterious Two. And I thought, well, if I did one of the first, I want to do one of the last. And that was my idea. And I know opticals inside and out because I began my career on an optical printer. Mm. And I thought, I can turn a set into an optical camera, and then the entire negative can be first generation. That was my real goal, is to have this the most beautiful film that anybody's ever seen, because there's no interpositive, no internegative. You can print the movie from the original negative. And that's what we set out to do. It was unbelievably complicated. The script, actually, if anybody's interested, they can go to the library at the Academy, the Margaret Herrick Library.
Uh-huh.
And my script, which is about a foot and a half thick, is there with all my overlays and everything.
Oh, cool.
I had storyboarded every shot. And not only storyboarded the shot, but showed in the script how to shoot it, because nobody understood what I wanted to do. So I put it on paper. Mm. I spent a year designing the shots.
It shows. Visually, it just seems like a masterclass in those shots. And there's so many canes in it. It's just all the canes. I love that. But yeah, so obviously the shoot went fine. The first pass of your film was fine. What was the problem with the ending? Why did that, was it you wanting to reshoot the ending, or did
I had an ending that I wanted to shoot on the film, and it was at a time that MGM was having some problems, and they wouldn't let me shoot the ending that I initially wanted to shoot because it was way too expensive.
Yeah.
And so they asked me if I could shoot an ending that would be a lot less expensive. And I said, yeah, we can, but it's not going to be very good. And we shot that ending, and it was awful. It was horrible. It did not work. And you had this film that rode a level, and then boom, boom. And the film was too short because they wouldn't let me shoot, and I had the – it was like a difference of almost 17 pages.
Oh, well.
So I finally talked the studio into shooting the ending the way that it was supposed to be, and we were in pre-production. I had gone – I had left the movie, and I went and shot a pilot that I had to do for ABC that I had already been contracted to do. And came back to start pre-production on shooting this ending. And during the time that we were doing that is when Heather passed away. Mm. And which led to one of the worst days of my life when I was a pallbearer at her funeral. It was the worst. That was the worst thing that I have ever had to do in my life. Yeah. Was carry that little girl's body in a box.
Yeah, unbelievable.
And it was just awful. It was Henry Winkler and Brian Gibson and myself and Barry Bernardi, I believe, and David Wardlow, who was her agent. And we were the pallbearers, and one person from her family. Yeah. We were the pallbearers at the funeral, and it was doo-doomp.
And then you still have to go and shoot this ending after that, which
and then
I can't imagine.
Well, we weren't going to. Laddie didn't want to, and Jay didn't want to, and I didn't want to, and the board at MGM, which I said on the commentary when I did the Scream Factory, and they cut it all out because they said that MGM would have been upset.
You can say it here.
Yes.
Well, I'm saying it here. MGM just said, if you don't finish the movie, we'll get somebody else to finish it. And they said that to Jay and Laddie as well as to me. And Jay and Laddie actually were at that point leaving MGM. And they did. And that's when Kerkorian brought in the new crew whose job was to put the studio into bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And doo-doop. And, you know, then the studio comes back to me and says, oh, well, thank you for finishing it, and you can make any movie you want to make. Bring us a script and we'll make it. And the script I brought them was Lisa, which I loved that script.
You know, I saw it only for the first time like 3 weeks ago at a triple feature. It was the last, it played in the New Beverly.
Yeah,
it was the last
film. Sold out.
It's, the whole thing was wild, but it had, there's a moment in it that brought the house down. It was the double headbutt, the mother and the daughter headbutting each other. And I was like, I just turned to whoever's watching. I was like, I've never seen that before. It's like truly kind of an astounding moment.
Well, you did see it. Well, you saw it kind of in Vice Squad.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But a mother-daughter, I don't know. I thought it was brilliant. Yeah. It was a fun movie.
And listeners can go back and hear your thoughts on it.
Yes, they can hear that.
Back.
Did, but you were, you, before, I think before we were recording, you were kind of walking through what the ending was going to be, what you were planning on. That'd be a fun place to kind of, you know, towards wrapping.
Well, it was a very emotional kind of ending where Tangina was offering to sacrifice herself to Kane and to lead them to the other side so that they didn't have to come back again. And mm-hmm. and she would do that for them, and she would sacrifice herself if they would give Carol Ann back.
Mm.
And so it was a whole sequence where Carol Ann was on one side, and I didn't want to do it as a fancy special effect. And I really – and I talked to Dick Smith about doing it. And it was a matter of, with makeup, changing Tangina into Carol Ann and Carol Ann into Tangina. And it was going to be pretty difficult and pretty impossible. Yeah. But
if anyone could do it, it'd be Dick Smith.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing.
Dick Smith was unbelievable. And then, you know, the guys he had working with him, Caglione and...
The other one.
The other one. It's okay.
You've done pretty well with names. Your name recollection of producers you've worked with over the years is pretty astounding.
One is fine. I'm sorry.
You know, it was going to be pretty amazing. I wish I would have, you know, Dick Smith was the guy that taught Stan Winston everything he knew. And both of them are gone.
Yeah.
I mean, I've just, that's the thing. I've worked with Stan Winston. I worked with Dick Smith. I worked with Harry Frampton, who did Deathline. Mm-hmm. Harry Frampton did Alec Guinness's Fagin in David Lean's Oliver Twist. He was one of the greats. And I mean, all three of those guys were just amazing. Amazing.
Well, I think Scream Factory did an excellent job on Poltergeist 3 with all the features and stuff.
It looks gorgeous.
Definitely check that one out.
Yeah, it looks really pretty.
We don't want to wrap up. But literally the night that we are recording this is the night that Deathline is playing at the Cine Family in Los Angeles.
And I guess we should get you to the screening on time.
I'm driving Gary to the screening, so I have to get him to the screening.
Yes, yes.
But Gary, thank you so much for coming on the show and making it happen while you were in town. And I hope that you'll come back and we'll try to do a part two where we're not rushing you to a screening.
Good. I'd love to do a part two.
Because we want
to
know what happens in your next act.
And I want to, we've got much more to discuss. So, we'll hopefully see you again really soon.
We never talked about what's coming.
I know. But we'll get to it, I promise. And thank you, and we will continue this.
Ramrod 2 Electric Boogaloo.